Support for programming on NET Radio comes from the Sheldon Museum of Art, presenting a diverse menu, race, gender, class, and the things we eat. Discussion with Ichi Ome Olua, author of So You Want to Talk About Race, and Soleil Ho, food critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, along with an exhibition on art and food, is on view now, Tuesday, February 19th at 6 p.m. SheldonMuseum.org. And support also comes from History Nebraska. Nebraska archaeologists work side by side with private landowners to protect Nebraska's archaeological heritage. To learn more, history.nebraska.gov.
Good morning and welcome to Friday Live here on NET Radio, live from the Mill in Lincoln's Haymarket. I'm Robert Goldberg in for Genevieve Randall today. Ahead on this morning's show, we'll meet a guitarist known for his showmanship, playing multiple guitars at once. He and a variety of guitarists give a concert in Holdridge tomorrow. And in the next 20 minutes, Genevieve Randall will talk with an author and photographer who've created a book celebrating the 150th anniversary of the University of Nebraska. If you'll be away from your radio later, you can listen using the NET Nebraska mobile app or stream the show online at netnebraska.org. Just click on the button that says Live and On Demand. This morning starts with a full table of guests here to talk about a concert on the Arts for the Soul series at First Presbyterian Lincoln. The concert is at 7 p.m. on Sunday and features the First Presbyterian Choir and jazz singer Jackie Allen, who joins me. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, David.
There'll also be desserts, and the concert is a collaboration with Music and Memory. Brian Falter curates the Art for the Soul series. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Monica Gell from Sumner Place Skilled Nursing and Rehabilitation in Lincoln to talk about Music and Memory. So welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Jackie, we'll start with you. You've been joined on this concert by Hans Durham, your husband, bass player, and Tom Larson, keyboard. What will you be performing?
Well, I think this is a very interesting project, considering it like a project about music and memory, and something I've never been asked to do before. So it was very easy and fun for me to think back about different periods of my life and what has inspired me, you know, way before I decided to become a professional singer. So I thought about my grandmother, who loved to listen to music and had Alzheimer's in her 90s. And even at that point, when she couldn't remember any of us in the nursing home, she would be part of the music program, and she would sing, you know, hundreds of songs from her childhood. She could remember all of them. And so it's interesting, the human brain.
Absolutely, you know, the things that get tucked away.
Yes.
Music.
So I thought it would be fun, you know, knowing there'll be probably a wide range of audience members' ages, that we would select some songs from that my grandparents would have enjoyed listening to, and my parents, and then songs that I enjoyed. And I think about some of the early music I remember, aside from, you know, the pop on the radio, but I really loved musical theater or the television musicals.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, it's a great selection, and I think that's a lovely gesture to choose some music from the time of your grandparents and your parents.
Yeah.
Well, Brian, we're going to turn to you. Tell me about what the choir will be doing.
Well, we have several pieces. It's not the usual theme for choir music out there, so I had to do a little research. But one of the pieces, actually, there's a new hymn that was written. It's actually in the hymnal of our church that's called When Memory Fades, and it deals with issues of dementia and losing memory and all of those kinds of things. And so someone wrote a choir piece based on those words, and it's very powerful. I have several people in the choir who have had family members go through this, and they said it's very, very moving for them. So that's one of the pieces. There's also an old kind of a gospel hymn out there called Precious Memories. Mm. And then there's a newer piece with a little bit of a British spin to it called In Memory's Stream by Bob Chilcott, a brand new piece that's kind of lighthearted look back at childhood memories and things. So,
well, it's important, I think, to have that lighthearted look also.
Sure.
That can be beautiful things as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Monica, you're also a part of this concert. Can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what your organization does?
Hello. Again, my name is Monica, and I work for... I'm a life enrichment coordinator for Sumner Place that provides rehabilitation, memory support, and also long-term care. We are proud to be a members of Better Health Services community.
Well, you do wonderful work. So
thank you
for being a part of this as well. Are there examples of music tied with memory that you or any, or Brian or Jackie can recall, this link between music and memory?
So we started to work with this program a year ago. We were picked by Brown University to pilot this program. We were kind of so happy because they picked only four facilities in the nation.
Real honor.
And Sumner Place was one of
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And the main focus of this program was to work with residents who has Alzheimer's dementia and find the music, the key that they were listening, you know, when they were from the age 16 to the 26, because that was so much impactful, you know.
So that's the age that they found music makes the deepest impact.
Because, you know, they were graduating high school, they were getting married, having babies, and that was like the main key in their life. Going back.
That's interesting. Wonderful. Brian, I can't help think that the title of your entire series, Arts for the Soul, is just so apropos, this particular concert. How do you see it fitting into the wonderful work that you all do?
Well, the Sync from the Heart is something that we've done almost every year since we started, I think with one exception. And so we try to highlight a local charity, something in the community that we can help out. We take a free will donation for that, and we highlight what they do so people understand a little bit more about it, because I don't think, like Music and Memory, I don't think very many people know about. And the series in general, we try to find things that have some meaning beyond just the musical portions of it. Like in the fall, we did a concert with the choir that was in remembrance of victims of violence. We have done concerts before with an environmental theme. We've done a Middle Eastern group. So we try to find things that have something beyond just the musical part of it. And
wonderful.
This certainly fits into that.
Well, you all do such wonderful work, and I think this is a wonderful collaboration. I've been talking with Brian Falter, singer Jackie Allen, Monica Gull, and all of us to talk about the Dessert Charity Concert presented by the Arts for the Soul series to benefit the Music and Memory Program at Sumner Place. Jackie Allen will be joined in the concert by Hans Sturm and Tom Larson. The First Presbyterian Choir will also perform. And the concert, titled Sing from the Heart, is at 7 p.m. this Sunday at First Presbyterian Lincoln. Brian, Jackie, and Monica, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for having us.
There's much more ahead here on Friday Live. In the next 15 minutes, I'll be joined by cinematographer, editor, and director Alexandria Bombach, who is in town for an event at the Ross in Lincoln tonight. Serving your community anywhere that might be, NET Radio is Nebraska's public radio network. I'm Robert Goldberg. Here on Friday Live, I'm joined by one of the performers on a concert coming up in Holdridge at the Tassel Center for the Performing Arts. International Guitar Night is tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. and promises something for everyone. The guitarist who joins me now is Luca Stacagnoli. Thank you for joining me, Luca.
Thanks to you.
Luca, you grew up in Italy, and if you visit your website, it's obvious that your playing is unique and innovative. There are other guitarists joining you on your concert in Holdridge. Are you all touring several places together?
Yes. Me and the other guitar players have been put together basically for this tour. Previously, we did not tour together. And since the North America International Guitar Night tour started, we've been already in probably 14, 15 cities, and we still have 13 left to go. So a total of 28 or 29 concerts.
That is a big tour. I know you're talking to me from your car, a 12-hour car ride. How many guitarists are there in the car there with you?
So we are four guitarists and I would say four, five, six, seven guitars.
I found links on the TESL website to videos of you, Antoine Boyer, Samuel Lito, and Turkish guitarist Cenk Erdogan, all very diverse playing styles. So how do you put a program together?
It's very interesting to put a program together because at the beginning we also did not know what to expect. We did not really know how our styles could blend together and sort of make sense, but it's something that comes spontaneously once we're there in person. We just let you know and we get maybe fascinated by a particular aspect of the playing of the others. And we're like, oh, you know, I love that. How about you keep playing that and I do this? And it's just an exchange of opinion. And we are lucky that we get along so well, both on stage and off stage. So it was kind of easy for us to find some sort of chemistry.
So there's some improvisation, so you don't necessarily know what you're going to play when you walk out on stage.
Well, right now we have a program, but at the end of the show, from time to time, we ask people, for example, to simply give us four notes. And with these four notes, we create an improvisation right there on the stage. So this is something that we have fun doing.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Fun for the audience as well.
Yes.
One of the pictures on your website, you're holding a guitar that looks like it has three necks on one kind of conjoined twin guitar. What is that and how do you play it?
Yeah, this is my latest guitar. This is it's called Reverse Triple Neck Guitar. Basically, it includes a normal neck, a neck which is made of only high pitch strings, and then a reversed bass neck. So you play it really opposite. And it's an interesting instrument because it involves also playing percussions with the elbow, and there's a particular position. So it's something probably easier to watch than to explain.
It doesn't sound easy to play, though.
No, it's not. Not easy. but fun.
Oh, it's good for a challenge. In addition to playing a number of guitars at once, or physically interesting guitars, you play a number of styles. So what are your thoughts on categories of music? Classical, jazz, pop, and so on.
I think I can speak also on behalf of the others. I see that we're really enjoying lots of different styles of music, from classic to jazz to rock to even metal sometimes, also pop. We like a little bit of everything. It depends from song to song. And it's interesting because also in our repertoire in the concert, there really is a bit of everything. So some well-known songs, some classical music, some traditional, Turkish music or some composition. So it's a sort of a 360 degrees program.
Well, that's perfect for an international guitar night.
Yeah.
Luca, I want to ask you, when did you first start making music and start playing the guitar?
I started when I was 10 years old. At the moment, I'm 27, so it's been a while. And I started with classical guitar, and then later on, I discovered from YouTube some new particular techniques of playing involving percussions, and I fell in love with those, and I started learning a lot of them from the internet.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can learn on YouTube.
Yeah, we're a lucky generation nowadays.
Have you put any of your own work up on YouTube for others to learn?
Yeah, sometimes. So I don't do tutorials on YouTube, but I see that what I did in the past was simply playing the normal performance and then trying to copy from that. I know that, for example, guitarists such as Tommy Emmanuel used to do this with from the radio. So they did not really have a chance to replay the piece. They really had to be fast and do it while the performance was going on. At least I had the replay button. So nowadays I play some songs and some guitarists of younger generations try to learn these pieces doing the same. I also have some sheet music for them if they ask, but no tutorials for now.
That's great. Well, you're passing it forward, as they say. I've been talking with guitarist Luca Stricagnoli. He is one of four very diverse guitarists performing in Holdridge tomorrow as part of International Guitar Night. The concert will feature styles as diverse as folk, French cafe swing, pop, flamenco, and more at 7:30 p.m. Luca, great talking with you, and thank you for your time.
Likewise, thank you so much.
And you can link to the TESL website for more information by going to the NET website, netnebraska.org/radio, and look for Friday Live. The Hammond family have farmed in York County, Nebraska for generations. A new book follows the small family-run farm through a year of their lives. Writer Ted Genoways shows a Nebraska farm dealing with issues that go far beyond their county.
This place that seems sort of isolated and remote and removed from the cares of the world is actually really at the nexus of all of these national and international issues and how they come to bear every day as they're in the tractor seat.
Here, Nebraska writer Ted Genoways discusses new book, This Blessed Earth, the One Book, One Nebraska selection for 2019. Online now at netnebraska.org/allaboutbooks.
Holding in my hands next here a beautiful new coffee table book. It's written by Kim Hachia with photography work by Craig Chandler, tracing the history of the University of Nebraska from its charter until now, which has been 150 years. All this week, there's been celebration going on for the University of Nebraska. The title of this book is Dear Old Nebraska U, Celebrating 150 Years. And Kim Hachia and Craig Chandler join me now. Welcome to Friday Live.
Thanks, Genevieve.
Thank you.
Great.
We're excited to be here.
How did each of you become involved in the creation of this new book?
The direction for the book started about 2 years ago, and I worked at the university for about 25 years, and I also worked at NET, full disclosure. And so when they needed a writer, they kind of turned to me, and I said, sure, I will do that, because I have kind of a long institutional history. And we brought Craig on because Craig is a fabulous photographer. And so there's a lot of new work, his work and others' works in the book, but also some historical things. And the book's published by the University of Nebraska Press, so I want to get in a plug for them because they did some magnificent editing, and Craig and his photo people did some amazing work.
I'm director of photography, best job on campus. So I was kind of responsible for getting, we have 30,000 plus pictures in our archive over the last 10 years. And that's all the new stuff. The old stuff came through Love Library's special collection headed by Mary Ellen Ducey. And they get so many requests, they have these almost at hand. So they pulled more than maybe 500 photos for us as our starters. And as we went down the list of stories we wanted to do, things we wanted to tell about, they were able to pull out pictures. It was fun.
I imagine that is kind of a fun process to go through all of these photos.
The fact that they still exist, that they're easy to get to, there's just amazing moments. These very historic photos when University Hall was the only building on campus and there really wasn't a town around it. It's just amazing to think of now.
And some of the photos then are yours as well.
As we went through the list, one thing the university has changed very much in 150 years is, say, the number of international students. There's 153 countries last semester who had students on campus. So working with international, they were able to twist some arms and brought in 11 students from different countries. I went through all the little handheld flags we have of all the countries. And so there's a photo of the 11 students holding about 8 or 9 or 10 flags apiece to represent everybody.
Now, it's really interesting, too, to see some of the history included in this book. For example, students of Japanese descent who were accepted to UNL during World War II.
Right. That's how my father came to the University of Nebraska, because he was raised in California, and then his family was sent to the internment incarceration camp in Wyoming, and the university and many universities accepted students out of the camps. My father had been at UCLA. And so he came to Nebraska, and after he served in the Army, he came back to Nebraska and went to medical school, and that's kind of why I'm here. My dad and my mom met. She was from Columbus area, Genoa, and they met. And her parents had also gone to the university, so I have deep Husker bona fides. I grew up in Lincoln, and the university has just always just been a very important part of our lives. And so it was really an honor to be asked to write this book because it, you know, the university is a meaningful part of my career. I got my degree from here. It was really an honor to be asked.
There's even a page about the beginnings of NET television.
Yes,
having happened on campus.
Well, you know, we wanted to kind of highlight some of the things that make our university unique. NET is an important, unique thing. It was, you know, one of the first statewide networks. McBride and Ron Hall and those folks had vision. And that's kind of a through line in the book, is the idea that these people had vision. But these people had this audacious, bold vision that they were going to have this university, and it was modeled it on the University of Michigan and Harvard and all these, you know, so these big ideas. And so there's a lot of big ideas in the book, and that's what we kind of wanted to bring out as a through line of the big idea. And also not only looking back, but looking forward. What do we hope to accomplish?
Were there surprises for either of you?
Being able to look through the old pictures, I mean, that you can just sit and do that all day. And everything from where was that taken to where it was not. From those photos in hand, we redid the alumni calendar for this year. That's a mixture of old and new photos. So it's fun to be able to take an old photo and hold it up and say, well, that building's not there, but this is now. It's just amazing, the people.
Yeah, I think the big surprise for me sometimes was just stumbling across a person I had not heard of, but some of the cool stuff they did. The one that particularly stands out for me is this woman named Gladys Rowena Henry Dick, who graduated in 1900. She was a student of Charles Bessie, a botanist. She ended up going to, I believe, Johns Hopkins to medical school. And in 1924, she and her husband, Dr. Dick, they were both physicians and working in Chicago, and they discovered that scarlet fever is a virus and how it's transmitted. And they developed a vaccine that was in use for over 50 years, and they were nominated but did not receive a Nobel Prize for that. Well, that's a pretty amazing story. I'd never heard of Gladys Rowena Henry Dick, but yeah. Now I know about her, and I tell everybody I know, because I think that's just a really amazing story. I mean, we all know about Johnny Carson and Clayton Yeider and all these kind of, you know, mm-hmm. big captains of industry and politicians and Warren Buffett. So we know about them, but the smaller people, many of them are women, and their stories are not well known or well told. I was kind of on the lookout for those kind of stories, so I was glad to kind of, you know, relight her candle a little bit.
How has it felt putting this book together for the university's anniversary?
Well, I mean, it made me really proud. I hope when people get the book that they feel a sense of pride that this place has mattered, that it has made an impact, it will make an impact in the future. Our current students are our future alumni. We know they're writing their stories now, and they're going to go out and they're going to show their grit and their glory, and they're going to make us all proud.
I've been talking here today with writer Kim Hichia and photographer Craig Chandler about their book, Dear Old Nebraska U, celebrating 150 years, marking the 150th anniversary of the University of Nebraska. And both Kim and Craig are headed off to a book signing this morning from 10 a.m. to noon at the WIC Alumni Center on UNL's city campus. So, Kim and Craig, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be sure to have a link to University of Nebraska Press on our website where you can find more information, and you can find that on the Friday Live page at netnebraska.org/radio.
Also tonight, in celebration of the past 150 of the University of Nebraska, an event is being held at the Lead Center for Performing Arts, featuring performances by students, faculty, and alumni from the University of Nebraska. It's called Celebrations of Music and Milestone, N150, and it starts tonight at 7:30 p.m. I'm Robert Goldberg. Stay with Friday Live. We'll have highlights from our arts calendar. We'll learn about a concert in Kearney. And Genevieve Randall has a discussion with playwright Denise Chapman, whose show in Omaha this week explores relationships, race, and a changing North Omaha neighborhood. A few months back, in September, a very special 23-year-old woman spoke in Lincoln to a crowd of a couple of hundred Yazidis. Lincoln is home to the second largest Yazidi population outside of the Middle East. She spoke about her terrifying experiences at the hands of ISIS, how she was taken hostage, and among other things, what happened after she escaped. Her name is Nadia Murad, and she is the subject of a documentary made by my next guest, Alexandria Bombach. The film opens tonight at the Ross Media Arts Center and runs through Thursday. Bombach will also be at tonight's 7:30 screening for a Q&A with the audience. Alexandria Bombach, it's a pleasure to have you here this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me ask you, how did you first come in contact with Nadia and hear about her story?
I met Nadia in the summer of 2016, and at that point she had been campaigning and doing her advocacy work for about 8 months. So I remember seeing her give her first speech that she gave at the UN Security Council in December of 2015, but we didn't meet until 8 months later. And then I followed her for 3 months as she was going from country to country, giving testimonies and interviews and really navigating this very bizarre world of advocacy.
How did you approach the making of this documentary, the structure or parts of Nadia's story that you wanted to tell?
Well, at that point, Nadia had been interviewed so many times and told her very horrific story so many times, and seeing that, I saw that that was such a traumatizing thing for her. It was never easy to retell and retell and retell the story, and she was also becoming so incredibly famous among Yazidis and the world, and so there was so much pressure for her to hold this weight and do what she can for the Yazidi people, and in many ways she is the face of the Yazidi genocide. So for the approach to the story, it really was about kind of taking a behind-the-scenes look at that, of what that pressure was like for her, and that's why the film's called On Her Shoulders, and really taking a critical look at how we're hearing stories of survivors, how we're, what our responsibility is to these stories that they're telling us, and making sure that we're not just hearing them, you know, sensationalizing them, gawking at the trauma, and then turning away, but as Nadia asks, really doing something, taking action.
The title is, as you said, On Her Shoulders, and in the end of the trailer for the film, a voice says, "Although she's the strongest person I've ever seen, I don't know how much more strength she has." What do those words mean to you and the film?
Well, so much of the film is really, like I said, this behind-the-scenes look. We're seeing Nadia as we've never seen her before, you know, practicing for these speeches, really speaking to Yazidis at refugee camps in Greece, and understanding, you know, the pressure that she feels. And, you know, people talk about her strength and resilience and all these things, but so much of what she's doing is out of survivor's guilt, that she has to keep going because she doesn't really have an option. And in many ways, she's a reluctant activist. And at that time, especially, and they were going so, so quickly, you know, they were doing interviews from 7 a.m. and you know, people wanted to talk to her until very late at night, and that was every single day back to back. And it was exhausting even following her for 3 months, and I can't imagine the stress that she has and the weight that she carries, and she still does today, and in many ways it's changed the dynamic of her work, but also since becoming a Nobel Peace Prize winner, she has a lot more responsibility and more notoriety for this role, so that's continuing on to this day.
Yeah, and a reluctant activist, that's really so important to keep in mind, really, because this happened to her, and the story came out of her without her really asking for it. So
yeah, and so in so many ways, I think a lot of times people's first reaction is to just celebrate her and call her strong and resilient, but I think that doesn't make us really have any responsibility and understand our own complicit nature and not helping Yazidis, especially as U.S. citizens and other countries needing to step up and really do what she's asking for instead of just giving her awards and accolades and all the pageantry, really taking action.
Which is what a long format documentary is able to put that message across.
Yeah.
We mentioned the Yazidi population in the United States and in Lincoln especially. What are your thoughts about that and the film showing here specifically in Lincoln?
I think, Nadia visited in 2017 as well, right after we finished filming, and I was really hoping to come here, but the budget ran out. So I've been wanting to come to Lincoln since I started filming Nadia. It's something that was a huge deal to her, and it's an honor to be here, and I'm very honored to be representing the film and just be able to meet Yazidis today and listen and be around a community that I've been so invested in thinking about for years now. So it's a true honor.
Where is Nadia now, and what's she up to?
Nadia's continuing her work. She's all over the world giving speeches and testimonies, and a lot of her work has changed since the Nobel Peace Prize. But yeah, she's still doing her thing.
The documentary is On Her Shoulders by my guest, Alexandria Bombach, followed by the sometimes unwilling activist for the Yazidi people, Nadia Murad. The film was a 2018 Sundance Film Festival winner of the Directing Award, U.S. Documentary, as well as winner at several other festivals, including Southwest Film Festival and Human Rights Watch Film Festival. Alexandria Bombach will be in Lincoln at the Ross Media Arts Center for the 7:30 screening tonight for a Q&A with the audience. Thank you so much for talking with me about your documentary, Alexandria.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Friday Live, coming to you on NET Radio from the Mill in Lincoln's historic Haymarket District. Did noisy traffic or a loud passenger in your car just interrupt your Friday Live experience? The digital world has given us a do-over. We podcast the show each week. You can look for that later this afternoon on our Facebook page or on our website. The address is netnebraska.org.
Genevieve Randall, you're listening to Friday Live here on NET Radio.
Be sure to check out the arts calendar on our website, both to make plans and to add your event. The address is netnebraska.org/radio. Just click events. Here are some highlights. In Chadron this weekend, Chadron State College Theatre presents Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike in the Black Box Theatre at Memorial Hall. Shows are tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 with a matinee Sunday at 2 p.m. The Wildwoods perform at the Lark in Hastings tomorrow as part of the Listening Room series. That concert is at 7:30. And the Lincoln Youth Symphony celebrates Black History Month with a concert on Sunday at 3 p.m. playing music by African-American composers William Grant Still, George Walker, and Duke Ellington. The concert will be at Lincoln East High School at Sunday at 3. For more information about these and other events, visit our website, netnebraska.org/radio.
Support for humanities-related programming on NET Radio comes from Humanities Nebraska, delivering opportunities to engage with history and culture on the web at humanitiesnebraska.org. And support for programming comes from Constellation Studios, a mixed-use artist workspace for all types of printmaking and paper projects, featuring printing presses, bookmaking, type shop, and wet paper studio. For info, constellation-studios.net.
A dancer based in Iowa will bring her ensemble to the Minden Opera House. One of the ballets they will perform was inspired by war, but also the hope for peace.
It's actually very hopeful because as a result of her experience, her friends got together. They put a memorial up, a statue of Sadako, with paper crane up in the Peace Park at Hiroshima, and it kind of sparked an international children's peace movement.
Hear this week's Friday Live Extra podcast to learn more by downloading it wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the NET website at netnebraska.org/radio. I'm Robert Goldberg. Concert Association presents the string duo The OK Factor this Sunday at 7:30 p.m. at the Merriman Performing Arts Center in Kearney. With this kind of eclectic music, it's unusual to have the combination of cello and violin in concert. Joining me now are Olivia Dirks, the O in OK Factor, and Carla Colahan, the K in the name. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Robin.
Olivia and Carla, the first letter in each of your name make up the OK in your group's name. But there's more to the story of how you came to be known as the OK Factor. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, say first off that you're the first person to just right off the bat know that we are O and K, Olivia and Carla. Sometimes it takes folks a while to catch that connection, but we are, you know, we're a new classical crossover duo. We formed in college. We both went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and just fell in love with alternative styles of playing in the midst of our classical studies, and found this mutual love together and decided to start writing.
Where does the word factor come in, the OK factor? What is it exactly?
You know, it was just one of those college names that sort of formed out of other ideas we had. We would put post-it notes up on our wall in our dorm room with names for ideas for our band name, and it's sort of the idea that you know, when you put the two of us together, it's different.
Speaking of that, are you both classically trained on your instruments?
We are, yes. We've both been playing our instruments since we were 4 and 5, and studied classically all throughout using the Suzuki method. And continued our studies in college. And like Carla mentioned, it was our junior year at Luther College that we really discovered we both, while we loved classical music, really had this love and desire to sort of expand into alternative styles of playing. And I think that comes from our broad listening background. We listen to lots of different genres of music, and that heavily influences what we write. And it's been an honor and a privilege.
Well, there is so much influence these days, it's almost hard to imagine anything really that exists all on its own without some kind of influence.
Exactly, yeah.
How do you classify what you play? Would you call it classical crossover, alternative folk, something else?
We're going with new classical crossover right now. We believe that it is broad enough that it allows us to do basically whatever we want, but still speaks to our classical foundation. Using that technique and the stylistic things that we love about classical music and infusing them into our own original compositions. So we've tried alternative folk or progressive folk, but they didn't necessarily speak to our classical training. So we're honing in on that a little bit.
That might change over time, a work in progress.
Absolutely, yeah. We're always looking to expand and try new things. So we don't feel pigeonholed into this category whatsoever, but it works for right now.
Well, what can people expect to hear at the concert on Sunday in Kearney?
Yeah, well, we're so excited to be in Kearney. We've heard wonderful things about the Merriman, and we're just thrilled to be in that beautiful space. So if we expect a lot of our original music, just cello and violin, acoustic, instrumental music. And we also do some singing. We'll bring along a couple ukuleles, a soprano and baritone ukulele, and share some covers with the audience. We released a new Lullaby and Love Songs album January 1st, so we'll be sharing some tunes off of that. And it should just be a really, really fun evening.
Well, that should be appropriate this week of Valentine's Day, Love Songs and Lullabies.
That's right.
You're both so talented. Tell me what it means to both of you to be finalists for the 2018 McKnight Fellowships for Musicians in Minnesota.
Oh my gosh, it was such an honor and unexpected at that. We had applied the year before and made it to the second round, but not the finals. So just 2 years into starting to apply for grants such as the McKnight Fellowship, it was a huge compliment and a real boost for us. Doing what we're doing.
Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Olivia Dirks and Carla Cullahan, thanks for telling us about your concert and your music.
Thank you.
The Kearney Concert Association presents the OK Factor this Sunday at 7:30 p.m. at the Merriman Center in Kearney. This is the bonus sixth concert that was added to the normal five-show season with support from the KCA Endowment. For more information about this concert or anything you hear about on Friday Live, go to netnebraska.org/radio and find the Friday Live page. I'm Robert Goldberg.
Production presented by the Union for Contemporary Art in their theater will feature original work by Denise Chapman, informed by the history of North Omaha. Denise Chapman is producing artistic director and theater for Union for Contemporary Art, and she joins me now to talk about her play. Denise, nice to have you on the show this week.
It's really great to be here.
Now, the play, as I mentioned, is an original work written by you. The title is More Than Neighbors. Now, this has something to do with the construction of a highway in Omaha. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your original inspiration for writing this.
We moved here when I was about 7 years old, and I grew up in North Omaha. Spent a lot of time in different parts of the area, and as I grew up, just started to notice some of the differences in what we claimed as our home and our neighborhood and our community and other parts of the greater Omaha area. And as it grew and fell into theater and started to wonder, how do I use the arts to bring attention to or to ask questions or to create space where conversations about the past that have a direct impact on what we understand our present is now. How do we create that space and how do we create that kind of work? So this is actually the second play in a series that looks at the history of North Omaha especially, and looking at the expansion of the North Freeway and what it really did to not only the physical space, but also our understanding and practice of the work community.
Thinking about what the construction of that highway did to the neighborhood you grew up in, it seems like there could be a lot of layers in the title of the show, More Than Neighbors.
Looking at my own family across three generations and how community was practiced, I noticed a shift. So when my grandfather passed away, we were at his funeral, and so many people came up to us during the repast to share these stories about, oh, you know, your dad or your grandpa, you know, helped our family out. He shared coal. He bought shoes so I could be on the track team or on the basketball team. And there was a story after story collected like this, and my grandfather never talked about that. Like, a lot of those stories were brand new for us after he had passed. And my grandparents are part of the Great Northern Migration. They came from Alabama through Chicago and landed in a small town of Danville, Illinois, And then my parents both grew up in Danville, and during a time when the factories were really big and everyone knew everyone and people were looking out for each other, some of their favorite stories are talking about going to a friend's house and sitting down and having a meal and then having to get up and go take out the trash or sweep the floor or do the dishes because you were just family. You weren't a guest in the home. And then watching how, as different outside factors started to affect the physical layout of those communities and how that practice shifted, but watching how they practiced community in the way that they could, and then looking at my, I guess, generation and my understanding of community, which lives in a little disconnected place because of the physical disconnections, but also in a place of reclaiming. So I intentionally bought my house off of 24th and Mary Street over by Miller Park because that was the neighborhood that I grew up in. That was the neighborhood that fed me and helped me to grow into the person and artist I am today. It's this multi-leveled examination of a title that really questions, what does it mean to be a neighbor? What does it mean to be a community? And how does that practice shift and change when it's physically torn apart?
Part of what people who attend the play will see is a display of photos. What's in that display?
We decided that we would add a little piece of our own personal history to the set. So it is a collection of photos from everyone's family. And it's been fun gathering them and seeing people's grandmas and great-grandmas and aunts and uncles and cousins and little versions of actors. So there'll be a little treat for all of our audience members to look through those and see if they can recognize any of the people that they also see on stage.
What role does race play in the storytelling and in the history of North Omaha?
It plays a major role in it. And, you know, Omaha is no different. If we look at this trend that we see in major urban areas across the country, where you go through a time of redlining and civil unrest and civil uprising and then ghettoizing and devaluation of property, and then they build a freeway through the middle of it for suburban and white flight. And then, you know, fast forward 20 years and you're in the middle of gentrification as everyone is trying to get back closer to downtown and into the original historically rich. I'm air quoting those words.
Denise Chapman is the playwright and creator of More Than Neighbors. Shows presented by the Union for Contemporary Art in Omaha are February 15th through March 3rd. So that show opens tonight in Omaha, and we'll have a link on the Friday Live page at netnebraska.org/radio. Denise, thank you.
Thank you.
Informing and inspiring Nebraska with unique programming, this is NET Radio.
When life is neglectful and unkind, if you want to live, you'll find a way out. Joaquito Dreher has this preview of the film now showing at the Ross.
We've been bombarded lately with this sight of children in those, you know, very, very difficult situations. And you always have the feeling that they're paying the highest price for our faults, children that didn't even ask to be here.
That is Nadine Labaki, director of her award-winning film, Kafirnaam. Set in the small country of Lebanon, Labaki dramatizes the story of Zayin, played by Syrian refugee Zayin El-Rafia, a 12-year-old boy who sues his parents for the crime of birthing him and then neglecting him and his sister. After tragedy strikes his sister and his parents do nothing to protect her, he flees from his home and survives by his wits in the streets. On his journey, Rahil, an Ethiopian migrant worker played by Yordanos Shifero, shelters him with her infant son, Jonas, played by Bolowatif Treasure Bankole. Eventually, Zain becomes the sole caretaker of Jonas after a series of events entrap his mother. Taking a cue from the Italian neorealism of Vittorio De Sica's film The Bicycle Thief, Labaki plucked her actors from the streets of Beirut and produced a most dramatic and inspirational story of rebellious youth, whose story leans to François Truffaut's The 400 Blows of the French New Wave era in cinema. Even the title of the film finds currency in literature and biblical history.
This is a word that's been used throughout history in French literature and English literature and even Arabic literature to signify chaos, to signify disorder. It's originally it's a biblical village, and it was sort of cursed by Jesus because of the chaos that was in it.
Capernaum is riveting in its delivery. Zain inhabits every chaotic scene with an intensity that you will be hard-pressed not to attempt to reach for the screen to carry him. It is one thing for Zain to manage his own life, but when he assumes responsibility for Jonas, the story transforms into a heart-rending journey. Christopher Ayan's cinematography interprets the unbearable day-to-day, filming against the backdrop of a variety of issues, extreme poverty, slums, immigration and migrant workers, children and forced labor, the separation of children from families, child brides. Zain's knit and grit fail to alleviate the distress. Every dramatization of his daily life is overwhelming.
Yes, for you to be overwhelmed by all that, because this is the reality, and the reality is even more overwhelming than what you see, is even more ugly than what you see in the film.
And audiences at Cannes were overwhelmed and in such awe that the filmmaker and her team not only won the Grand Jury Prize at the festival, in addition, they received a post-screening 6-minute standing ovation, plus more applause on their way out of the theater. A bit of trivia. The events the Ethiopian refugee Rahil experiences in the film happened to the actress who plays her, Yordanos Shifera, in real life 3 days later. Capernaum plays through February 21st at the Ross Media Arts Center in Lincoln. Also, the Ross Gets You Ready for the Oscars showing through February 20th is the Oscar Shorts. For Friday Live, I am Waquito Dreher.
Opera Omaha presents Donizetti's The Elixir of Love this weekend. KVNO's Corbin Hirschhorn tells us more.
Opera Omaha's production of Donizetti's L'Elixir d'Amour, The Elixir of Love, opens this Friday at the Orpheum Theater. It's the company's first time working with Italian director Rosetta Cucchi. As a director and concert pianist, Cucchi has been on the stages of Santa Cecilia in Rome, the Royal Theater in Madrid, the Japan Opera Foundation in Tokyo, as well as numerous other theaters in Europe, Latin America, and now the American Midwest. In this Italian comic opera, peasant Nemorino falls hopelessly in love with noble Adina. But soldier Belcore isn't making the situation easier. Opera Omaha's production has been reimagined, true to the original libretto, but recontextualized for the modern era. Cucchi explained her process as a director, finding new light for a classic story.
I am a musician, so I always approach an opera playing the opera at the piano, which is something that gave me a plus of taste, exactly what the music wanted to tell you. So when I first approached this opera, I thought that the real fil rouge, the real link of this opera, is the youth. The youth is all over this opera. They are talking about young people. They are talking about the dreams that young people has, the passion that young people has looking forward, looking at their future lives. And so in this story, we have Adina, Nemorino, Belcore, all of them are young people ready to go in their life. The first love the first approach of love. So taking care of these feelings, I thought, why don't we place this story in a school? Because it's only in a school that you can find this light feeling, this light passion. And then I said, let's do a step forward, not only a school of arts, a school of performing arts. Why this? Because I attended a school of performing arts, as every other artist. And during my high school, what was my feeling? One day I will be a star. One day I will be successful. So I think in a school of arts, the passion are very high. And everybody wants to be something, wants to be someone at some point of his life. So all the character is, let's say, over the top, because their character is like this. We are talking about a book that is telling the story of Isotta. And from that book, every dream comes out. The dream of Nemorino to be loved by Adina, the dreams of Adina to be a star. So I placed my story in a school of art.
Kuki's Elixir is set in the United States, influencing set and costume design and even body language. It's also inspired by a film that is now remembered as a symbol of the 1980s.
When I was younger, I remember a very famous series that was called Fame. Probably everybody knows that this is old actually now, but it was so inspiring and so full of happiness, full of joy, full of dance. So I have to say that I took the inspiration of my elixir from that series. And then at some point I said, okay, let's collocate, let's place the character in this school.
For cast and crew, resetting an opera isn't a frivolous endeavor. After conceiving the production, it takes time to make sure that every note, gesture, and thread does the original justice.
After this process that takes a while, actually, is not very fast, especially if you decide to move forward the story, because you have clearly to decide which time, which location, which kind of costumes, and then look if anything of those things clash with the music and the story. For instance, the most difficult thing was really Belcore, because when we talk in the real story about Belcore, Belcore is a soldier. So we had to think about dramaturgically how to fit this in this story. And this is always happen, and probably is the beauty of this job, to research what you want and how to arrive.
Opera Omaha's production of Donizetti's The Elixir of Love will run this Friday, February 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday the 17th at 2 p.m. at the Orpheum Theater. For more information or tickets, visit operaomaha.org. For Friday Live, I'm Corbin Hirschhorn.
I'm Robert Goldberg, and wrapping up today's show, I'm joined by artist Wendy Jane Bantam, who's been chosen as the fourth artist in residence for the Cornhusker Marriott Hotel's Artist in Residence program. Welcome back to Friday Live, Wendy, and congratulations on being chosen for the residency.
Thank you so much.
This is the fourth year that the Cornhusker has held the program. For listeners that may not know what an artist residency is, can you give them perhaps a brief description of what you'll be doing?
Absolutely. Residency programs exist within institutions for artists to reflect and create work that they've been researching. Those include the Rocky Mountain National Park. NASA has a space program which invites artists in residence.
NASA has a space program.
The BMIS. Well,
NASA has a space program. NASA has an art program.
Laurie Anderson, the violinist, was their resident artist to create a series on moons, moonscapes. There's currently an artist in residence there that works on climate change. But the BMIS has one in Omaha, and the Marriott has this one.
That's wonderful. Well, from my understanding, there are several rounds of competition before you get chosen. So what were all those rounds?
Several rounds. You submit your CV and a portfolio of your work, and then the public is asked to vote. And there are many artists that apply. And then once you reach that second round of voting, then you're invited by the board to have an interview.
Wow. So that's quite a grueling process. Get through there till the end. A part of the residency includes entertaining clients, having a studio and a gallery always on display. Will this play a different role, do you think, in how you create art?
Well, often I will go for exhibitions, yeah. And I speak with people, and I teach workshops through the Lead Center for Performing Arts. So my hope is to hold workshops at the Marriott to invite people to come and learn about the process. The work that I'd personally like to create, I grew up in the western sandhills of Nebraska, and my father worked for the Lakota Sioux. And I've always been interested in the mythology and the storytelling of different cultures and the land. I've worked in residencies in Indonesia and Turkey and Greece, and so my hope is to explore my own land and the mythology around Nebraska in the pieces I create at the Marriott.
Right. Well, it's a wonderful venue for it because the space is right there in the public space of the hotel, so it almost invites people to come in, and you've got a story to tell with your art, so yes. It's wonderful to have the flow of people.
And I love to hear other people's stories as well.
Your residency begins in April. When do you have a plan to prepare for the residency, and will you be creating any pieces in the meantime before the residency starts?
I'm working pretty steadily to prepare for the residency. As an artist, it takes time to create those bodies of work, but we do have a full year with this residency, so I will be starting pretty much right away in April when I move in.
Wonderful. Your paintings are typically very vibrant, and they often include animals and scenery. How do you think the residency might, you're talking a little bit about it, affect this inspiration? Do you think it'll change in any way the kind of art you make, having this sort of this opportunity to have your work basically on display as it's created in front of people?
You keep saying in front of people, and it makes
me
extremely
nervous.
That's true.
No, there's not going to be an audience. I'll tell you why, because I've walked by there, and
you do feel like you're being stared at.
I just poked in and said, knock, knock, hello, what a lovely painting you're drawing. I didn't want to interrupt. So people do drop in.
We are affected. Artists are affected by their surroundings, yeah. And so I found when I've worked in other residencies, I've worked out in fields or barns or been working with the public in public projects like large-scale murals. Mm-hmm. And it actually is a wonderful dialogue. It creates a great dialogue. And I don't imagine it would affect the color because my ideas exist in my mind, right, but sure. You take in everything that's surrounding you. And there's so much history at the Marriott. I remember when it was the original Cornhusker, I actually witnessed it. When they imploded it, and then we all went down to watch, and then they've rebuilt it. So many stories surrounding the Marriott there, yes.
Yeah, you're quite right. It's an interesting building, and they have art displayed from previous artists as well throughout the building.
Yes.
I know they're going to have some gallery nights, so to speak, during the residency. Have any of those been set yet?
We have an opportunity for 12 First Fridays during that full year. We will most definitely have one in the first Friday in May.
Wonderful. Well, that's lots to look forward to. So congratulations again. Wendy, we're thankful to have you on the show today. If you're interested in visiting Wendy during her residency, beginning in April, her studio and gallery will be stationed at the Lincoln Cornhusker Marriott Hotel. To learn more about Wendy Jane Bantam and her paintings, visit our website at netnebraska.org/radio. Thank you again, Wendy.
Thank you so much. It was nice to meet you.
You too. Coming up this morning on NET Radio, classical music on Morning Concert, and this afternoon, Laura Black and Classics by Request. Be sure to visit the NET website for podcasts of the show at netnebraska.org/radio. Thank you to everyone who makes Friday Live possible, including Elise Stasny, Genevieve Randall, engineer James Duchesneau, and associate producer Dave Hughes. I'm Robert Goldberg.
Support for programming on NET Radio comes from the Lead Center for Performing Arts in Lincoln, presenting the San Francisco Symphony March 28th. They return to the lead, led by conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, performing the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in E minor and the Sibelius Symphony No. 2 in D major. For ticket information, leadcenter.org. Also, Pittenger and Anderson, a Lincoln-based fee-only investment advisor providing fiduciary financial advice and investment management to individuals and families. PNA, your financial advocate, online at PITTAND.com. And Nebraska Repertory Theater, presenting Dutchman. Two passengers on a subway uncover race-triggered anger and fear lying just below the surface of polite America through February 24th. For showtimes and tickets, leadcenter.org.